You're listening to WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, broadcasting at 99.3 FM and streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Melissa Fratterigo, whose book Glory Days came out in September from the University of Nebraska Press. The book is part of their Flyover Fiction series. Melissa Fratterigo is also the author of a short story collection, The Longest Pregnancy, published by Livingstone Press. Her fiction and nonfiction has appeared in more than 40 literary journals and anthologies, from Shenandoah and the Massachusetts Review to Story South and Notre Dame Review. She has been a finalist for awards from Glimmer Train on multiple occasions, twice nominated for Pushcart Awards, and was the winner of the Sam Adams Zoetrope All-Story Short Fiction Contest. She teaches classes on the art and craft of writing at the Lafayette Writers Studio in Lafayette, Indiana. Here's a little information about Glory Days. The small plains town of Ingleside, Nebraska, is populated by down-on-their-luck ranchers and new money, ghosts and seers, drugs and greed, the haves and the have-nots. At the center of this novel is the story of Teensy and his daughter, Luann, who face the loss of their land even as they mourn the death of Luann's mother. Some townspeople find enormous wealth when developers begin buying up acreage. When Glory Days, an amusement park, is erected, past and present collide, the attachment to the land is fully severed, and the invading culture ushers in even darker times. In Glory Days, Melissa Fratterigo combines gritty realism with magical elements to paint an arrestingly stark portrait of the painful transitions of 21st century small-town America. She interweaves a slate of gripping characters to reveal deeper truths about our times and how the new landscape of one culture can be the ruin of another. When I spoke with Melissa Fratterigo, I began by asking her to read the first few pages from the opening chapter of Glory Days. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I didn't believe him for the longest time. 3 years since Mama's passing, and he continued to see her. Day before the sale, I heard him scramble into his pants and flannel, laces crisscrossing, light still murky, uncertain. I knew he'd caught sight of something from his bedroom window. I pulled on socks and the back door swung wide. I followed him, imagined Mama's words in my ears. Look after your father, as if she'd known, as if somehow she'd known. Outside, Daddy's boots broke dirt clots. The little land we had left went on unplowed, just stubs of corn, old mud ruts, now dry. He didn't want me to follow him. Tess, he called, my mother's name. How had he gotten so far? When I caught up to him, his face shined with sweat. I tugged his elbow. Let's go home, I told him, shivering with chill despite the wet heat. He took off. I heard emptiness rattle inside his shirt. He refused to eat. He said nothing tasted right. I looked up in the direction he ran, saw a woman in a gray gown and overcoat. She plodded firm with her back to us. Tess, he said to her, please. I didn't want what he claimed to be true. I had stood beneath the old oak where they set the stone with two engraved names. I thought I remembered crying. I reached him again. He put a hand up to silence me. The sky peached and the moon receded. We followed her across the colorless grass and into the trees. Briars caught on the length of her gown, glare on the river, everything lifting with fire, a new day. We came up on her. He reached a hand out to her shoulder to turn her, and she looked at us, a stranger, eyes wild and unfocused. She shoved Daddy, no weight to hold him steady, and he flew, backside hitting a maple we sometimes tapped. The woman kept on, and Daddy looked dazed, egg-like lump rising on the back of his head. Tess? His face sheened white. She's dead, I reminded him. Luann, your mama's never going to forgive me, he said, rubbing the bruise. Losing her people's land like this. We watched the woman descend into the river furrow, move along the dry bank. He told me that was no woman but a ghost, said ghosts were everywhere and they were nothing to fear. Your mama's the one I'm waiting for, bound to come back to give me a piece of her mind. His shirt had opened wide at the neck, and I could see the rippled skin from his burns. It made me feel uneven. In response, I petted my own neck, traced its smooth plane. I tried to tell him there's no such thing as ghosts, but he gave me a hollow look like I had no real thoughts in my head. I was scared, and once we arrived home, I dove onto my bed, covered my head. Truth be told, if she were upset with anyone, it would be me. After a bit, I tried to concentrate on summer sounds, peepers and gassy toads. I listened for her footsteps, stiffened in my bed, counted my breaths. Mama? It could have been 10 minutes or an hour that passed. When I lifted the blankets, I blinked into darkness. Mrs. Sparkman arrives early with two women from church. They set up the tables, talk about the new priest, the upcoming pancake breakfast, the heat. They set out buckets of ice and jugs of sun tea. I bring stuff from inside the house and set it on the tables. Old clothes, the little jewelry she had, dishes and kitchen things, a couple stained dolls. Daddy's in the barn with the men. As we work, the women ask me questions out the sides of their mouths. I am 8 now. Do I like to swim? You must get lonely out here, no playmates your own age. They click their tongues, wear looks of pity. I twirl with my arms up, white dress from grandma swirling, curls scraping my shoulders. I stop when I start to get dizzy. They applaud, say I am cute. Come here, sweetie, one of them says. My left hand chews up my dress fabric. Come on now, she says. I won't bite. I obey and she touches my hair. It feels like a sponge. Darlene, feel this. Another one comes by, fingers my head. When they lift their hands, I slink away. Pretend I'm checking out the cookies set out on paper plates. Gonna be trouble later. Nobody knows her people. Hush, girl's right there. Mark my words, adoption's not right. More people arrive. Plastic bags hold purchases. The cash box fills. Everyone buys bits of us until only remnants are left. Mismatched socks, an egg timer that doesn't work. I hold Daddy's hand when the auctioneer clears his throat and waves a hand in attention. The driest year Daddy can remember. July isn't even over, and the trees have already dropped their leaves. Tassels on the corn are dry, frittered things. Daddy had to give up the cows. There was nothing for pasture and nothing to pay for feed. The river smells of mud, decaying fish. Daddy's not the only guy paper mill laid off. He's just the unluckiest, he says. The buckets of ice have turned to water by the time they are done. Some shake Daddy's hand or squeeze his shoulder. Take care now, they say. We sit on the steps and watch the train of cars leave land that has been in my mother's family for 3 generations. Land the bank has sold. Dust whirls. We sweat. Vultures spoon the sky.
Thank you so much for reading that. That's fantastic. I love that. Vultures spoon the sky. You have wonderful, sometimes you use these verbs and I'm like, oh, that's, wow. I never thought about that.
I love to think about how language can be used in a different way. I think it makes it a little bit more electric to read too.
Absolutely. And you had another one about something. I didn't keep it. Something peaches something. Let's see.
The
sky peached. And then as the sun is rising, I assume this is as the sun is rising, glare on the river, everything lifting with fire, a new day, which of course there's themes of fire in this book. So that was wonderful too. So thank you for that. I wanted to talk a little bit about the delivery of information to readers at the beginning of a book. You know, in the beginning, we don't know anything ever when we open a book. And right. You do this wonderful job of bringing us into a situation rather than telling us what's going on, letting the characters talk about it, and we're just flies on the wall. One example is, you know, Luann, your mama's never going to forgive me, he said, rubbing the bruise, losing her people's land like this. And then the other one is that incredible scene where the women are touching her hair and we learn that she is not a white child and that she's adopted. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about delivering information to kind of make it more organic for a reader?
Yeah. I love that question because, well, you're the first person that's first of all asked that, but it's something that I think about all the time.
Oh yeah.
As a reader myself, my favorite books are the ones where I feel like the author values me and values my own perspective and my brain and lets me figure things out on my own. Whereas I think sometimes you might encounter a text that maybe doesn't trust the reader as much and wants to add up everything, add up the whole equation for you. So when I'm writing, in order for me to feel a part of this world, and also to demonstrate, I guess, that that interest in what the reader brings to the story or to the text, I'm real aware of what I need to put on the page to take a reader to this place, and then what I can also leave off, what a reader is going to be able to bring to a situation. I mean, I could just say it's morning, the sun is rising, or I can, you know, as you noted, kind of describe things in a way so that the reader has to kind of come up with a picture in his or her own mind. And I think that when the reader is able to do that, their experience is a lot more involved and richer.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good point. I think that by wording it in a way that's not what we've always seen before, that, and I won't go so far as to say that all those other ways of wording things are cliche, but things that we're familiar with, we don't even have to think about what we're familiar with. Whereas if you word things a little bit differently and use, as I said, interesting verbs, then it gives us pause and we are forced to come in. Do you know?
Yeah.
I just think that's really helpful. That's great. Let's see. There's a point a little farther into the book where Luann, it's a different chapter. She's also the point of view character in this one. She's arguing with her doll I'm not going to go into too much detail about what's happening right in this scene, but she's in a place where a storm has come through and the world is just in disarray. There's just junk everywhere from this, from things being thrown. And she's with this little Barbie doll, and the doll and she are having a little bit of an argument, which is great. And then she says at one point, "I am the big person and you will do what I say, or I'll throw you away like all this other junk." And I read that and then I kept reading. And then as I was finishing that chapter, I kept going back to that line. And once again, I feel like you are subtly delivering some very important information about what's going on in Luann's mind, about what she thinks about herself, about what she thinks was done to her as, you know, a child who was given up for adoption. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that. And I also think writing children's dialogue is different than writing adult dialogue in some ways. Do you remember writing that line in that moment?
I do a little bit. That was a story that came pretty fast. And notice I just called it a story. That was a chapter that came really fast. And I think it's because it occurred in a pretty short time frame. I mean, I think the whole piece is maybe 30, 40 minutes long or something in terms of the story time. But a lot of what I was trying to do, I think, with Luann and with a lot of the characters, is really get inside their heads. Mm-hmm. The book actually started, it didn't come out in a chronological order.
Yep.
So even though Ruin, the chapter that you're talking about, is the second chapter in the novel, I actually knew a lot more about Luann at this point in time because I had written her, my first introduction to her was actually when she was in her 20s. And I'll leave it at that. So I already kind of knew her life story, so to speak. So I think it provided an opportunity for me to have a deeper connection to her and understanding of how all these pieces in our lives add up. Sandra Cisneros has that great short called 11, and you know, early on in the first paragraph, the narrator says she has a horrible birthday. Her 11th birthday is horrible. She has this run-in with her teacher who thinks these horrible thoughts about her, and the little girl thinks, you know, on my 11th birthday, I'm not just 11, but I'm 10, I'm 9, I'm 8, I'm 7, I'm 6, I'm 5, I'm 4. It's kind of this backwards trek. But I think we as people feel that as well. I mean, even though that Luann in that chapter is, you know, about like 9 or 10, again, I had a deeper knowledge of where she ultimately ended up in life. So I think that probably helped in crafting that dialogue between her and the doll.
Yeah. Oh, it's really, it's very, very good. And that whole chapter, and you know, I don't want to go too deep into what happens in that chapter because I preferred as a reader to discover it myself. But I will just say that throughout this book, as we also heard in your reading, there's the possibility of ghosts. There's communicating with the dead. There's a way of seeing actually what might happen to us, you know, how we will die, or how certain characters will die. It was really fascinating. And I wondered if this has been a theme for you in the past as well, or did it just make sense in this particular novel?
The theme of kind of ghosts, the unknown, or
yeah, and magical elements, ghosts, afterlife, ideas of the afterlife.
Yeah, it hasn't.
Okay.
To be honest, so and maybe that's, you know, also what you're picking up on in the book, and that is that I've never had so much fun writing as I did when I was working with this novel, because there was so much that was surprising to me and that I was discovering in the process of writing it.
Yeah.
The book itself came out of a dark period of my life. Mm-hmm. Somebody very dear to me was diagnosed with cancer, and I wasn't able to sleep and I wasn't able to do much eating. But what I started to do is I would wake up very early before the rest of my family, and I was able to read poetry. Mm-hmm. And I was never been somebody who really has read many poems in her entire life.
Yeah.
And yet it was the only thing I found palatable. I couldn't even write a paragraph or a sentence. But I could read these poems, and they felt really calming to me.
Uh-huh.
And something about that form, the conciseness of a poem, and also how, you know, you mentioned earlier about the use of verbs in a different way. I think poets have a lot to teach us about looking at language in a new fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually started to keep kind of an image journal, and the writing prompt that I will mention later in your show, I'll kind of talk about something that correlates with that. But I started to keep an image journal where I would just jot down some of these words that I felt were really electric and resonated with me in some way.
Oh, yeah.
And then one day I was actually, so despite the fact I wasn't doing any active writing of prose at that time, I was still going to the library and, you know, I still somewhere in some buried way felt like a writer. And one day I went to the library and there was a gentleman that would welcome me into the parking lot, and I hadn't seen him for a couple weeks. And then one day he was there, and I just mentioned that, you know, I haven't seen you, I've missed you, I hope you've been well. And he said, well, you know, I've been south. I was burying my mother and my sister.
Mm.
And that was it. It was one sentence. It was one line.
Yeah.
But it started a chapter. And the line that I heard suddenly in my mind was, Gardner hears dogs scrambling up the trees after a squirrel or a neighbor's cat, he tells himself. eager to be calmed. It's not teensy, he thinks. The same thing he's been telling himself for months. Teensy doesn't want anything to do with him. Isn't the sort who craves revenge. And that was the whole start of Teensy's Daughter, a chapter that's like three quarters of the way through the book.
Wow. That's amazing that that just came to you and that sparked a whole story for you.
It really did. And I think the cool thing is that, like even in those couple lines I just noted, you know, I was introduced to, you know, this animosity between Teensy and Gardner. And then a couple lines further down, I discovered Teensy's got this daughter by the name of Luann. So I had these three characters, three really compelling characters within this one chapter. And unlike other things I had written, I kind of couldn't shake these characters. And in terms of ghosts, we find out in that chapter, actually, Luann is somewhat of a ghost. So I realize that I'm absolutely miles away from your initial question.
No, because that's all related. No, I mean, I think that the idea that you started writing about the about ghosts, you know, sort of like taking up part of the space that we exist in, and that interplay of what we see and what we know is very interesting, and that you started with a kind of dark period. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, actually, that was a question I had for later, but I'm going to ask it now. So I wondered about writing when the subject matter is dark. This book is very beautifully written, and I really enjoyed reading it, but it is dark, and even on the publisher's notes, it's described as gritty and very real.
Right.
So did you ever want to turn away and work on something lighter on the side? Did you do anything else while you were writing this?
Well, I mean, I do write some creative nonfiction. Those pieces could be lighter in tone, but you know, the long and short of it, I think as a writer, you don't always have the answers. You don't always know why this is the project that's calling to you.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the best policy is to give your full attention to the project in front of you, rather than thinking about how, for instance, this book may not be for everyone. You know, not everybody wants to read something that's I think in some ways realistic. I mean, not everybody has an ideal life, I guess.
Right.
And that just depends on perspective. So this book may not be for some readers, and another book may not be for another reader. But I think in order to be a writer, I have to honor the story that I want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you do that, then you're able to kind of make some of those decisions that feel appropriate to that story. You know, when we're talking about language or even, you know, the structure of the book, you're kind of following this path, and that can be really exciting because of that surprise factor, because you don't have all the answers. And then it can also be frustrating. There's no doubt. Oh my gosh, the book took 5 years to write. There's no doubt at many times I didn't know if I could make it a coherent novel. But I guess I kept going.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, and I want to just mention, of course, there are light moments. And one moment that just, I loved it and I kind of smiled is the way that Luann's father, Teensy, and their friend, Mr. Arbuckle, talk to the cows.
Yeah.
The way that they talk to the cows is just so lovely and you know, come here, darling. And I don't know. It was
absolutely
just tiny little moments like that where you just are, you know, you first of all get a feeling for what it's like to be on a farm, and it's a hard, hard life. But yeah, the cows, I just enjoyed reading about the cows and how everybody, you know, has to kind of like coddle the cows to get them to stand where they're supposed to stand and do all this stuff. Anyway, that was fun. Did you grow up on a farm at all?
You know, I didn't. In fact, I grew up outside of Chicago in a suburb, so I couldn't be kind of farther from that kind of a childhood. But I currently live in Indiana, and it was when we moved back to the Midwest from the East Coast. I lived in Philadelphia for a bit there, and, you know, was in a tall building without much green space around me. And it was when I moved back to the Midwest that I found the land held a different sort of power for me.
Right.
And I really kind of got swept away by, there's a fair bit of farmland just right outside my community and right outside my door. And I just love looking at those wide open spaces.
Yeah.
And we have a babysitter, and she and her husband raise beef cattle. So I had been on their farm a fair bit with them, and they were kind enough to, you know, let me watch them and learn how they work the cows. And I really became enamored with these large animals.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just a weird obsession that developed in adulthood, an interest in cows.
Okay. Now, I am making an assumption, but it's an assumption also based on your author photo. You're not African-American. Is that correct?
Not.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk to you about writing about Luann and writing about her being dark-skinned. And I wondered if you drew on any particular experiences or stories to share perspectives on race from her point of view.
You know, on a personal level, I do have darker skin. My father's Sicilian, and I can remember as a kid in my elementary school classrooms being teased about my skin color and about possibly being African American.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember that. I can remember the feel of that. And I don't think that I've ever quite let go of that. And despite the fact that I'm not African American myself, it was something that was just very much in my head as I was thinking about Luann and about her kind of uncertain identity and how that can also complicate somebody in a small town when your background is unknown.
Right.
In a smaller community, sometimes it's your name, it's the legacy of your family that comes before you, before who and what you are. And I think that all went into play as I was considering Luann's history.
It was very moving to me to read about this child growing up in farm country and the only dark face, as she puts it, you know, in her community. I thought that was very well done, very moving.
Thank you.
Now, these chapters, you sort of mentioned before, you called one of them a story and then you laughed and corrected yourself, but these chapters really do feel like stories that can stand alone.
Right.
So did you publish any of them apart from the book?
I did. I published a couple of them as standalone stories, and the University of Nebraska Press, my publisher, they have, you know, we've published Glory Days as a novel, but in essence, it is a novel in stories.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
each of the chapters are standalone stories, but when you read it from beginning to end, it has the same feel as a novel. And as I mentioned, that also allowed me to write it kind of out of chronology.
It's out of chronology. It's like the point of view shifts, and it's very interesting to be able to read all these different stories that then come together in this very satisfying whole.
Yeah, and I liked that with this format, with the novel and stories. You know, in a regular novel with a regular linear narrative, we have, it kind of goes back to what we started out our discussion talking about, you know, all the pieces are kind of laid out.
Right.
All the aspects of the equation, you know, must balance at the end. And with a short story, you know, that balance is contained within, you know, your 15, 20 page story. But in a novel and stories, it kind of takes the best of both worlds in that, you know, you still have the same sense of completion of a novel. But what I liked about it is it allowed me to provide some gaps in time.
Yep.
You know, we talked about Ghosts, where Luann, in the opening chapter, she's about 8. And then in Ruin, the second chapter, she's about 9 or 10. And then the third chapter, Bait, she's a teenager.
Right.
So
right.
There, you know, and I have heard from some readers, I said, well, I don't, you know, what happens between then? And, you know, that's where I'm asking the reader, if they feel like going along with me, to read in, to infer their own conclusions about what's taking place.
Yeah.
At these junctures. And I think also because I was reading so much poetry, and I was so interested in the way that poets use space.
Yeah.
Not just on the page, you know, not just literally, but also like figuratively. I feel that there is, there's more of an opportunity to leave some questions mm-hmm. for the reader in a poem. And I felt like the novel and stories form supported that as well. And that was something that, again, in my process of composing the book, I felt really excited by.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing that's really interesting in the way that the book is put together is that you could do... Structurally, you're able to kind of use the themes of the book in interesting ways. So there are themes of motherhood, of birth, fertility, belonging, abandonment, and life and death. And so interesting, and so many threads that are intertwined in this beautiful way. And I felt like the short chapters that felt like standalone stories were able to do a lot with structure that maybe you couldn't do in a more conventional novel. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you found your structure. You say it took 5 years to write the book, so I'm wondering if part of that was putting it all together in different ways as you went.
Absolutely. I mean, I mentioned when I read those couple lines, the start of the novel that occurred when I met this parking lot attendant. So Teensy's daughter, as I mentioned, is about 3/4 of the way through the book. And that chapter introduced me to Gardner and Teensy and Luann.
Right.
And so then what I had to do was kind of work backward from that stage. I needed to figure out why Gardner and Teensy don't get along. I needed to find out why Luann was a ghost. And then what she was doing hanging around with Gardner. So these characters and the situations that they were in that initial chapter kind of compelled me to dig deeper. And certainly there were chapters that didn't make it into the final book. So for instance, I had a chapter that took place before Luann was born.
Oh, wow.
With her birth mother.
Okay.
Home for unwed girls in Chicago. And boy, I worked on it for a long time.
Oh, that's so hard.
it's the worst. I just couldn't get it to gel. And this is the same thing that I tell my students, the knowledge that I discovered from that story, I think it's still kind of fertilize the rest of the book going forward, or cultivated rather.
Yeah.
Even if that initial chapter didn't make it in.
Yeah.
So, no, I found as a reader, I love it when I am being asked to use my own insight and my background and my brain to figure out a novel, to make sense of it. And I felt like this format, the novel and stories, encouraged me to work with the questions that I had not just from these characters, but these situations, and as you said, like the themes that run throughout the book, and it was just a great deal of fun.
Yeah, yeah, it was fun to read. We haven't even talked yet about the title of the book, Glory Days, which refers to an amusement park that comes into their town, and it was just so interesting to see this farmland basically turn into an amusement park town. Yeah. How did you come to that idea?
Do you mean for the title or just for coming up with having an amusement park?
The amusement park. Yeah, no, the park itself.
Well, so I had Gardner and Teensy had Luann, and then I also discovered this woman by the name of Fredonia the Great.
Yeah.
And
she was
as you
amazing.
Know, Fredonia, yeah, she's fun. She's and she's pretty lighthearted in some essence.
Some ways.
Yeah,
I wouldn't want to get too close to her. I'm like,
probably. Well, I guess it depends, you know, what your inclination. It depends what you want to find out about your life.
Yeah.
So Fredonia is a woman with the power to, when she lays hands on a person, she can basically read their final moments and can tell them how they will perish. And she can also read, you know, the final moments of somebody who is recently deceased. So Fredonia the Great, when I met her, she was simply a standalone. She was simply initially just a standalone story, separate from the characters that I was crafting with Gardner and Teensy and Luann. And as I started to think about the picture that I had in my mind of this place where she, you know, lived with her husband when he was alive, and then just the work that she does at Glory Days at the amusement park, I started to realize that the landscape that I had in my mind was the same place. And I just needed to basically tighten the connection between the two. It was a really neat discovery because it just opened so much up for me.
Yeah.
about what it means when farmland goes belly up, when a ranching community is no longer able to subsist, and what happens to that land and what happens to the people that live there.
Right.
And again, you know, currently there's so much commercialization in our culture, and I was aware of that as well, and how that might feed into this fertile land that is no longer usable as farmland.
Right.
What might it be used for?
Right.
An amusement park. It's a perfect choice.
Yeah. Right. I love the cover of the book. And it's funny because I had the book for a while before I even focused on what it was.
Yeah.
It's the cover is a photograph of a very colorful amusement park at night, but it's under a stormy sky and it's a pretty dark cover, but the colors pop. And then the photo is printed sideways on the cover. It just seemed so perfect for this story that it should be printed sideways on the cover even. So did your publisher come up with this? Did they have a designer that did this, or how did this come to be?
Their designer did this. Her name is Lindsay Otten. She just did such a phenomenal work.
Oh, and it's amazing.
University, isn't it great? I love that too. That small tweak of shifting the words, you know, so it looks as, so the words and the image are basically not in alignment in essence. I thought it was just a brilliant little tweak.
Right. Yeah. Like they're perpendicular to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. And
yeah.
I didn't have any say in that. But I loved it. The University of Nebraska Press has done a phenomenal job of, you know, from the get-go, asking about my thoughts for the book and its cover and its design. But I didn't have any active role in the design process. But they did ask me questions about even what colors I thought would be evoked by the book itself.
Mm-hmm.
and images that I thought would resonate with readers of Glory Days.
Yeah. Now, How did you come to be published by University of Nebraska Press? Did you reach out to them on your own, or how did that happen?
I did. I did reach out to them on my own, and golly, I think I was just ridiculously fortunate too.
Yeah.
Like most writers, I had initially tried to go through larger presses in New York City, and I just wasn't having much, you know, good luck. And I think that that's really hard for a writer when you do feel like you have a book that's complete and you're waiting for somebody else to say, yeah, you know, this is something worthwhile, or I want to read this. And that's where I think you really, you know, that you think the writing of the book is difficult. Well, the process of getting it published, and then when it is ultimately published, sharing it with the rest of the world, all those three stages are all difficult in their own right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But I did reach out to the University of Nebraska Press because I knew they had a series called Flyover Fiction, where they specifically focus on kind of regionalism, books that evoke the Nebraska Plains, even Midwestern region. And I felt like this book, I felt like its landscape and the place where these chapters occurred, I felt like that was very much a part of how the book could be marketed and viewed.
Yeah. Now, Melissa, you're the founder and director of a writing program called the Lafayette Writers Studio in Lafayette, Indiana. So I wondered what kind of programs the studio offers, and how did you come to start this?
Well, I started it because I missed being around writers.
Yeah, that's why this show exists.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think at any time in life, you know, sometimes it's always easy to kind of complain about a situation, and sometimes, you know, we just need to put our thinking caps on and figure out if there's another way to problem solve. So I am several years out of my MFA program, and several of my writing friends that I've had throughout time have gone on to different things or might not be actively writing as much. And so as I've gotten older, I don't feel like I have that same community of writers. And when I moved to Lafayette, Indiana from Philadelphia, as I said, I really wanted to spend more time with writers again.
Mm-hmm.
And I am in the same community where Purdue University is located.
Oh,
but
wow.
I was also looking for additional opportunities for writers to come together outside of just academia.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, why don't I start a class? You know, why don't I offer a class and see if anybody else is interested in stories and in poetry and essays and you know, I offered a 6-week class called Writing Jumpstart. And this was in the winter of 2014,
mm-hmm.
and that class ended. And all the students said, "When's the next one?" And and we just kind of started from there. So I offer a variety of classes, from one night intensives that might just focus on one aspect of the craft of writing, to more extensive, you know, month long kind of critique groups where we workshop each other's work while reading a book very deeply, and then that author, I've usually connected with in advance and asked him or her to have an intimate conversation with us via Skype or Google Chats or something, and they talk about their process, because all of us, whether it be the teacher, which would be me, or my students, we're always interested, I think, in finding out about the process of that composition, and just having that chance to ask a writer questions one-on-one has been invaluable. And It's been ridiculously fun to offer these classes, and I have no doubt in my mind that Glory Days wouldn't be here if it wasn't for my students, because working with them and seeing them, you know, give their all to get their stories on paper and reflect and think deeply about their lives in the world, It absolutely motivates me and helps me put my bottom in the chair every day so that I can sit down and work as well. So as much as I would be thankful to the University of Nebraska Press, I also have to give my thanks to my students, really.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, speaking of sitting in the chair every day, what are you working on now?
I'm working on a pretty different project.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody had given me, although there are still some ghosts in it, somebody had given me some advice while I was still writing Glory Days, but I knew the book was pretty much complete, and mm-hmm. that was to start your next project. Start it before you, before you're just kind of sitting there twiddling your thumbs waiting for somebody to publish this book. Get going on your next thing. So okay. I've actually been working for a little while now on a young adult novel. It's still very much in process. It's maybe a little bit more linear in nature, but there are still some ghosts in there.
Okay. That's great. Okay, so I did want to ask you, Melissa, if you can recommend any books to listeners, either books you've read and enjoyed recently or books that have influenced you as a writer.
I love, in terms of characters, I love Circus in Winter by Kathy Day. In terms of structure, Stuart Onan does an amazing job with Snow Angel.
Yeah.
I've read that a couple times. Given Ground by Anne Pancake. She has a phenomenal attention to language that I really admire. And Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert is wonderful for greater insight into the creative process. And I think that this, starting out 2018, it's always helpful to, have some guidebooks in your back pocket for those doubting days.
So she's written a book on craft, is that right?
She has. It is. It's about craft, but it's actually more about creativity and the creative process and how to manage your own doubts and go forward.
Yeah. Great. All right. Thank you. So I just have one last question for you, Melissa. I wondered if you can offer any advice for listeners who are writers about introducing magical elements into otherwise realistic works of fiction.
I think that the best thing to do is probably start with the question, what if? And that's the name of actually another book of craft by Anne Bernays
and Painter.
Pamela Painter.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's called What If? But I think for magic and magical realism, I think you just got to let your imagination go. And it's a game that I play with myself a lot of times. And whether I am walking down the street and somebody's coming the other direction and I think to myself, well, what if they did X? What would I do? And in terms of sitting down on the page, I think you can let your characters have that same freedom to create. What if this character did this, or what if this happened in this situation? Sometimes I'll even brainstorm a list of possibilities for a situation.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that I'm looking for the most unusual situation, but rather I'm trying to figure out what's going to feel most natural to those characters and to be honest with that scene and scenario.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's great advice. Thank you so much. Before we finish, I just want to mention again that the name of the novel is Glory Days by Melissa Frederico, who's been my guest today. Glory Days is part of the Flyover Fiction series with the University of Nebraska Press. Melissa, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
It has been my distinct honor, Shayla. Thank you so much for having me on.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author Melissa Frederico. We discussed her novel Glory Days, published by University of Nebraska Press. You can learn more about her work at melissafrederico.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by Melissa. Take out a story, poem, or novel by a writer you admire and look at one page, any page. Isolate words that are evocative or pop for you. List them. Then use these words to write a sentence that feels like an opening and write your own paragraph or scene and insert it into this place. Feel free to continue adding words from your list to your scene. The objective is to use language in a striking way and let it prompt you to use vocabulary different from your own. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. So if you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, do let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.